Hey, how have you been sleeping lately? Do you need a little help? Maybe you just want to maintain a nice level of calm throughout the day. Either way, Lumi Labs has you covered. That's right, Lumi Labs are the masters of microdosing, and they want me to explain the benefits of microdosing using their Delta-9 THC gummies. If you're stressed out or your mind likes to run a million miles a minute, then you might want to give Lumi gummies a try. They offer indica, sativa, and hybrid gummies that are designed to be taken in smaller doses to maintain a level of calm throughout the day. Or if you just want the pleasant sensation of being a little bit stoned, you can take a couple more and you're good to go. I'm not going to tell you how to enjoy your Lumi Labs gummies. It's safe to say Lumi Labs is the longer sponsor we've ever had here at the KingCast, going on multiple years now, and I can personally vouch for their quality as they've helped me fight off insomnia and that dreaded vampiric sleep schedule that my body likes to default to. I do not know why my body does it, but left up to its own devices, I am asleep at dawn and up at dusk. Thank God for these Lumi gummies. They help me keep a quasi-normal sleep schedule. And the best part is you can get them sent straight to your door no matter what the marijuana laws are where you live. So check out microdose.com and see their wares. If you decide to pick something up, make sure to use the code KingCast at checkout to get 30% off and get free shipping. What a bargain that is. That lets them know that their ads worked, helps the show, and you get a nifty discount in the process. Everybody wins, baby. That's microdose.com, code KingCast. And it wouldn't be a KingCast episode if we didn't tell you all about our corporate overlords at Fangoria. That's right, Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. I have an article in the next one that's talking a little bit about Scott's passing and how I'm kind of dealing with it through the lens of Stephen King's work, of course. So hopefully that one doesn't make you cry, but it will definitely give you a little insight into where my headspace is at right now. That's the kind of great stuff that the Fangoria folks will let me throw in their magazine. And since we're talking about the wonderful magical words that come out of my fingertips, I'm going to go ahead and call it high quality writing. And this high quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine. So if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe. And to do that, all you got to do is head on over to fangoria.com and sign up. And if you use the code KingCast at checkout, you will save 25% off of your subscription. That's fangoria.com, code KingCast. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Advisor
will
see a dead body.
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm your host, Eric Vespi, and I'm joined today by the director of one of the best Stephen King adaptations ever made. Big words, but it's true. He's a writer and director who you know from his early Academy Award nominated film Evil, his exorcism movie starring Anthony Hopkins called The Rite, the Schwarzenegger Stallone two-hander Escape Plan. He has a new feature film out. It's a psychological horror sci-fi flick called Slingshot, starring Casey Affleck and Lawrence Fishburne, which is being released this Friday. His new movie has a lot in common with his sole Stephen King adaptation. It's an often overlooked, but not underappreciated, movie starring John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson called 1408. I think you've heard of it. We'll talk about the connections between Slingshot and 1408, as well as whatever other Stephen King nonsense pops into mind. In the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mikhail Hofstrom to the KingCast stage.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining me. This is really exciting for me here because me and my late great co-host Scott Wampler, one of the joys of starting this show, which had been running now for about 4.5 years, was kind of re-examining your movie, re-examining 1408, and realizing just how goddamn good it is. And it's something that I think we both clocked when the movie came out, and that we're like, oh, this is really good. But it's, once you kind of start looking at all the other Stephen King adaptations and seeing who gets it right, who gets it wrong, who, you know, adds new mythology to a story that improves it or detracts from it. 1408 comes out damn near the top of the heap. So I'm really excited to have you on the show.
Thank you for your kind words. Yeah, I mean, I think 1408 have new generations of audience now and again. It's been a few years, but yeah. I just, yeah, people, younger people now contact me about that film. It seems that it have a very long life, which is great, of course.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of staying power. Now, I noticed with the new movie, the reason why we're even chatting at all was because, you know, there was a director statement that you put out for your new film, Slingshot, where you were talking about how, you know, not so many words. I don't think you ever said it exactly like this, but it is kind of a spiritual sequel to 1408. And I was wondering if you could like dive into that without spoiling the new movie for everybody. Dive into the that comparison.
I think yes. I mean, first of all, it's the comparison is obvious for the fact that it's two stories that take place in very sort of narrow environments. In 1408, in a hotel room for most part of the screen time, with John Cusack alone in this room, and in Slingshot, we have a quite crowded small spaceship with Casey Affleck and two other guys. He's not alone in that spaceship, but he's still. It's a film about isolation and solitude and lost. I think what both films also have in common is lost love Cusack's character Mike Enslin have lost his daughter and he, when that happened, he also lost, you know, his wife. That relationship fell apart, and Casey Affleck's character, he's leaving someone behind when he goes on this this journey that will take years and years and years. And obviously, you know, he part of the puzzle that the film lays is going back to Earth and to see him with her character played by Emily Beecham. So they have a lot of similar themes. It's also about, you know, about guys who slowly, both of them, loses their grip of reality. And with 1408, there's been a film that's been around now for quite a few years, and a lot of people and fans have been writing about it and have different theories about it. And it's really interesting and for me to sometimes I Google it and see what's out there, and I read this long, ambitious articles about the film, and it's like, it's very rewarding after this years to see that. But 1408, I think, can be seen as a film about a man who ends up in the hotel room from hell, or you can also see it as a film about a man who slowly loses his mind in a, you know, perfectly normal hotel room. And I think both ways are fine. You can definitely who depending on who you are, you can analyze the film in both these ways, and right. they sort of make sense. So I think what drew me to Slingshot was the challenge again to do a very different story in different situations, and but besides the similarities, but to do something in a very tight environment and just work with, you know, actors and dialogue and for most parts that I like those kinds of films, and I obviously, as it seems, sometimes might like to make them as well.
Sounds like you like to emotionally beat the shit out of your leading actor.
Yeah, actors like that too. You know, you should, you know, actors, that's the showcase for them. You know, being alone or being semi alone, it's you know, it's great. You have there's nobody else to. But again, obviously we have Lawrence Fishburne on the ship and Tomo Capone. So there is right. Even if John, played by Casey, is our main character, he has some company as well.
Right. Now, another thing that both films, I think, have in common are how time kind of gets folded into into the narrative in a weird way, where it goes beyond just flashbacks and whatnot. Mm. It's like sometimes the time streams overlap a little bit, and your main character isn't sure exactly which time that they're in. And that becomes, you know, I don't know. I think that's a very effective thing when pulled off correctly. And it's got to be something I would assume you handle delicately, because it could also, if you do it wrong, can make the audience feel like they've been cheated in a weird way. You know what I mean? Kind of like an easy jump scare in a slasher movie or something, where it's just like, well, it might be effective, but you know, it was unearned or whatever. People can feel that way. But I think that you handled it perfectly with both Slingshot and 1408, how you do that.
Yeah. It's interesting. Time is, you know, it's a tricky little thing, right. like Clive Owen says in Closer. I think in 1408, we wanted to create the sense of time disappearing. Or the audience doesn't think about time as a phenomenon. Like we don't know how long it's been. He doesn't know how long it's been. We have this alarm clock that restarts, you know, once and again, and so on. It's only just begun, like the Carpenter sings as a spooky theme. And then,
which, by the way, there's not really any other horror movie I can think of that could take the Carpenters and make it scary.
No, I think that's pretty unique. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Still, when I hear that song on radio once in a while, it's like it's very strange.
You're in the post office and you got to check the walls and make sure you're not locked up back on set somewhere.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I know exactly. but in Slingshot, deals with time in a slightly different way, obviously. But there we have the hibernation cycles that the guys are going through, which means that they sleep for some time during this trip that will take them years and years. Right. So they go into hibernation, and then they are, you know, mechanically woken up and to check out the ship and, you know, sort of see that everything is okay and spend some time awake and then go back. So that rhythm will also lose the sense of conventional time pretty quickly. We don't know. We get information from the ship's voice, but still we are drawn into a place where time doesn't really exist as such anymore.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's got to be even worse being in space, because it's not like you even have the cycle of the sun, you know, setting and rising.
No, you know, no, absolutely. Like you point out, we don't. And I think we don't know what happened to us when we go into space like that, because we haven't done that. We have gone to the moon, which was a great achievement at the time, but that's like now taking the bus somewhere. It's really straightforward, you know. But going on these kinds of journeys, that will take years and years. What happened with us? What's the consequences? We don't really know. Film can explore that, and film do explore that, like this film and others. You know, what happens to our mind in a situation like that? But we can only guess and make stories about it right now, because we don't really have the actual right. answer.
But it's a great backdrop for those reasons. And it's funny, you talked about looking at think pieces and trying to pick apart 1408 and you know, when is the narrator somebody you can trust, and when is he somebody you can't trust. You're doing that with 1408. You're going to be doing that with this new movie too. And I do like that there is a question, without spoiling things, what the ending could mean. And you could read it a couple of ways. You could read it at face value. You could read it, you know, as a layer of an onion. There's a lot of different ways you can read the ending of this new movie. And I can only imagine the kind of deep dives people are going to be doing and trying to figure this one out.
Yeah. No, don't ask me. I have no fucking idea.
Good.
But jokes aside, the point is that I don't. You know, it's up to you. it's up to you as an individual and an individual audience member and the person you are to do whatever you want with that audio, with that ending, and then you can discuss it with your friends and you know, you can have different opinions. I really like that. I think with a film that I see as so like quite complex and layered and psychologically sort of intricate, you can't, this is my opinion, you can't have an ending that sort of bite the audience on the nose. I think they will be, you know, pissed off about that. You can't have a,
right.
You can't just sort of have a simple solution to this very complex the complex stuff that the film is about. So you have to make the ending complicated as well, so it goes hand in hand with, you know, the general feel of the film. And some people may feel like, you know, they want a more sort of concrete conclusion, or some people will feel that it's rewarding to be, you know, to just have to think about it and make up your own mind what's exactly going on. So that's where we are with this.
I don't know what it says about me, but I lean towards the darker the darker version,
it. That's my point. And maybe your friend have a different, your friend with a lighter heart have a different.
I'm a fairly happy-go-lucky guy. I don't know why I love fucked up endings so much though. So
yeah.
It's like, I can talk all day about how Frank Darabont's chosen ending to The Mist is like one of the great movie endings of all time, where everybody else, it makes them want to, you know, put a barrel of a gun in their mouth, you know.
Exactly.
I don't know what it is. I'm a nice guy in real life. I don't know where this darkness is coming from, but I love a good dark ending in my.
Yeah, we are a bunch media. Of people who like the darkness in the cinema room, and we like the darkness on screen. You know, it's rewarding. You know, we leave it out there. It's better to do that than to go around being dark-minded.
For sure.
In real life. But myself
to not assume I'm some sort of serial killer and just, you know, that I haven't figured it out yet.
We need being scared. We need to confront that. We need to confront the darkness. It's like going to a comedy. We need to laugh. We want to laugh.
Right.
We want to be scared. It's we all have that in common, you know.
Yeah. So speaking of having things in common, we need to talk a little bit about your Stephen King origin story. So do you have a Stephen King origin story? Is this like the first time that he kind of popped up as a force of pop culture, or just a thing that drew your eye to him for the first time? Any of that?
I think the first thing I discovered Stephen King was through, I think it's the first film made out of his work, Brian De Palma's Carrie,
right?
The original one that came out when I was a teenager, and I was a big Brian De Palma fan, so it was really De Palma who drew me towards King, and then I read the book because I really liked that film, and I liked De Palma style. It's a great combo of King's intrigue and De Palma's cinematic style that meets in this film, Carrie, and obviously a great performance from Sissy Spacek, who I had the pleasure to work with on a TV show called Bloodline many years after that. And we talked a lot about Carrie. We talked a lot about her experience there. So that was a lot of fun. That made me read Carrie and read a few of his other books. And then a few years after that, 3-4 years after, obviously, Kubrick made The Shining, which maybe more than any other film put the spotlight on Stephen King and his work, obviously, and also the famous sort of conflict and Stephen King's feelings towards the film and all that.
Much to his chagrin, he is forever tied to the Kubrick Shining. Yeah,
yeah, all this great stuff. But you know, that's part of popular culture, and that is great. And but the film, obviously, what can you say? It's the film that we all have seen, and that's one of the more famous films of his era.
Right.
And I'm sure Stephen King appreciate that, even if he had something to say about the film. But so, yeah, so it came from those early days, really. And then, look, like everybody else, I have not read all his books at all, but I have read a few, but I saw a lot of, you know, films.
Right.
Everything from Cujo to, you know, and all these films that came in the 80s, late 70s, 80s, Christine and so on, you know.
Right.
And there is, as we know, a lot of films have been made out of his books, and some really good ones, and some really, a couple of really great ones, and maybe some not so successful, but... But that's what you get, you know. Obviously, with that amount of films that's being produced from his things. So and then I went on doing other things. And 1408 came up. It didn't come to me as I really, really is looking for Stephen King. Some Stephen King material, and that's no criticism at all. It just wasn't, wasn't in my head at the time. But I was working with the producer Lorenzo di Bonaventura. He made my first English language film. It's a thriller called Derailed with Jennifer Aniston and so on. And he had the rights to that short story, 1408. And he presented it to me, and there was a first version of the script, and it was very intriguing, but we needed more work. We called in Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, the writer team that written a lot of great movies, and
Ed Wood and
Ed Wood, for instance, exactly, good example,
People versus Larry Flint. Yeah, they're just wonderful screenwriters. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Good guys, fun guys. And we had, I worked with them on a few drafts of the script. Bob Weinstein was executive of the film over at Dimension at the time. And and then John Cusack, who I had met a couple of years before that, just sort of randomly, but he read it. I don't know exactly the details, but he called us up and said, "I read this. I really like it, and I'm on board." And then we had the film, and we shot it all in London at Elstree Studios, the same studio
where
Kubrick shot The Shining.
Right.
There was actually this fun moment when there's fire in the room 1408. And we had a couple of firefighters to sort of, break into the room and save Mike Enslin. And the prop guy came up to me and said, "Look, I have this axe here. That's actually the axe that that Jack Nicholson used in the Shining. I was figured it would be fun if you could use it here. Now nobody will know about it, but I said yes. That's fucking awesome. So that's the axe.
No
same
shit.
Axe. Same axe." I read the other day, funny enough, I read the other day that axe has now been sold on like eBay or somewhere, or for film fans buy things. Yeah. And so that same axe is now sold to some collector of
somebody with deep pockets. Somebody check Guillermo del Toro's house. that's my guess.
Yeah, yeah. So that makes sense. So it was interesting to shoot. We shot at the same stage there, but a couple of people that actually worked on The Shining worked on 1408 as well.
That's incredible. And I also love that you mentioned how like Cusack's the one that's kind of like, "Hey, I got a hold of this thing. I'm interested in this," and suddenly that makes the movie. You know, you get a legit star in there, and he's got a little Stephen King, connections. He was in Stand By Me. He later was. Go on to do Cell, not so great, not as big a fan of that one, but I do love that he feels like a great Stephen King protagonist. He does have that kind of down home guy. You buy it as the writer that's going around being the skeptic, but also kind of still wanting to find something. He's got the perfect mixture of cynicism and optimism, that guy. And I have to imagine that was a big kind of load off of your shoulders whenever he came on, not just because it made the project more of a reality, but also you know, he kind of fits the Mike Enslin type to a T.
He does, definitely, and I think he saw that himself. You know, he's a wanderer and a searcher, and he's doing all kinds of things. He's a theater. He was a theater director, owner, and he's a journalist. He's a music guy. He's all these things. He's searching. You know, he walks around searching for things. And maybe searching for himself in all this, what have you. But he's a very interesting person, John, and it was a great pleasure to work with him. And I think he carried a lot of this stuff with him into the room and into the character of Mike Enslin. And it was a tough performance to do. But you know, also actors. You know, they like to be in center of things. So it was very much in the center of attention in this one. But still, we started every day, me and Benoit Delhomme, the French DP of the film, and John in the room, like just the three of us sitting there on the floor and like talking about those. Because I did have the camera and the camera operator was obviously very important. It's always important, but especially here, because that's something he could relate to when he have no other characters to do that with. So we were talking through the things. Everybody, you know, came up with stuff, and we were sort of throw ourselves into these scenes. And obviously, my job was to keep trying, you know, steer the ship in the right direction. But saying that, a lot of things could happen, you know, during this journey, and we could improvise and we could come up with new things and that would work, you know.
Your job is also to keep the movie visually interesting when it's set in, you know, one of like two and a half rooms, you know. Predominantly. And so does this mean that when you're like blocking, that you have to look at blocking more as a character in the movie than you normally would have, or did you have the exact same approach to it?
Yeah, I mean, we decided pretty early on that to build the room, but not build it so that you could take walls out. We wanted to feel the claustrophobia in the room, so everything takes place. The camera and the DP and everybody else that needs to be in there is in the actual room. We didn't, as you often do in, you know, on sets, you take out the wall to make it more practical to shoot. So we decided that, and then we tried to construct during the production designer Andrew Laws tried to build a room that was generic and kind of boring, but also. You could walk around in a circle in that room. You could walk from the living room into the bedroom, into the bathroom. The bathroom had two doors, and you ended up in the hallway again. So that was helpful. Also, the ship in Slingshot have that quality. You could walk around in a circle. It's built as a circle. You may not think about that when you see the film, but that makes it feel much bigger, you know. You can run around there. You can. There is a scene when Casey Affleck is jogging around the ship, is running in this circle, running. That makes the space feel bigger than it actually is. And that was the same with the room in 1408.
Well, that's thematically really interesting too, because both of those movies have this feeling of repetition, you know, this feeling of, in Slingshot, it's the cycle of being awake versus being asleep for 9 months and whatnot, but in 1408, you know, he literally has a reset, you know, at a certain point when that clock hits, you know, the countdown hits zero, you think he's like, oh, what great horror, you know, element is this? And it's like, oh, the horror is that everything he just went through is going to repeat. And so you have that repetition, and that's kind of subtly laid in there. That's very Kubrickian, actually. I think, you know, people have dug up a lot of, theories and maybe like legitimate theories, I don't know, about the building of the Overlook Hotel and how it purposefully doesn't match up with what the outside is and how it's a maze inside. And some part of your brain knows there's supposed to be a window or doors there and there isn't. And it just makes it feel off. You know, that feels like a trick Kubrick would pull.
No, I think he was a master of that, obviously, Kubrick. He was a master of a lot of things. But, you know, the maze I mean, there is actually a physical maze there, but the whole, I mean, his Nicholson's brain is a maze as much as the Overlook Hotel. We don't really get a feeling for what's going on there. I mean, or how things are connected to each other, you know. But which is a good confusion. So yes, Kubrick definitely, and obviously in 2001. He was Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, I think he might have known what he was doing. I'm going to go out on a limb and say you know, that's Stanley Kubrick, pretty good director.
I think like everybody else, he had to find his way. I think I know people that worked with him, and you know, he was this genius master director. But you know, I think like all of us, he had to work hard and sometimes struggle to find, you know, to understand what the fuck was, you know, what. Maybe that's why he did 100 takes of everything, because he could, right. But also he was waiting for something, and maybe he didn't always know what it was he was waiting for, but when he saw it, he knew it, you know. Yeah. I mean, most of us can't afford to do 100 takes. We have to do like 5 or 6, and hopefully we get what we need. But but I can understand that. I mean, sometimes I'm really happy that I'm not in the position where I can make 100 takes, but it would be really, you know, I don't know if that makes things better, it depending on the actor. Some are really good the first 2 takes, and some need 5 takes to get, you know, warmed up, and then they deliver. So it's very individual.
Welcome to the Midroll Ad Read. I am here to tell you a little bit about the book The Devil by Name, being put out by Random House. No one expected the apocalypse would be broadcast by telephone, but in Keith Rawson's The Devil by Name, the follow-up to a smash hit, The Fever House, anyone who managed to survive that doomsday call has a harrowing answer to the question, where were you when the message came through? The Devil by Name is a heart-stopping saga set against the ravaged landscape of a post-apocalyptic America, one in which survivors are united by the desire to not just escape death, but to carve out some way to live anew. Stephen King, you might have heard of him, calls The Devil by Name exciting, suspenseful, and horrifying, and Publishers Weekly says that Keith Rawson's new novel is literary horror at its finest. The Devil by Name is available from Random House and can be found wherever books are sold. Now, let's get back to the show. Speaking of the actors, I want to get into the production design a little bit, but before we do that, because I feel like that's going to be a whole other thing, I love that you populated 1408 with a bunch of really great character actors around, because you're right, Michael Enslin, you know, he is the main character, you know, he's the one who has to carry the movie, but these other characters show up for a scene, or maybe even a partial scene, and they have to stand out. Was that your thinking of hiring people like Tony Shalhoub or Isaiah Whitlock Jr., you know, or I mean, even Sam Jackson, you know, for these parts.
Yeah, exactly. Sam, obviously, he have some great scenes. I mean, Sam, it was such a pleasure to work with Sam. There was a funny, you know, the idea of 1408 was to make it PG-13. So that was the goal. You know, it's not much violence or blood in it, so that was fine. But as you may know, in PG-13 films, you just have one fuck. You can say fuck once. So John was really like, you know, where am I going to say that? Where am I going to say that? You know, where are we going to use it? You know, something really cool. Then Sam Jackson came to set, and he pulled me aside at some point and said, you know, in this scene, wouldn't it be really cool if I said this? And I said, yeah, it would be really cool, but we got a big issue now. I gotta tell that to John. And right. I went to John and I said, look, I just talked to Sam, and he had this idea to say this in this scene. And John was like, oh. But I said, you know, it's Sam Jackson. It's really fucking cool, isn't it? And John said, yeah, I have to admit to this. So that's the scene when Sam Jackson gives him the key and says to Mike Enslin, remember, it's an evil fucking room. Mm-hmm. That was that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. There's just some, like, no matter how much you were looking forward to it, you just have to. Sam Jackson's the king of saying fuck. You know, you there's nobody else alive that's better at it. And if he wants it, you kind of have to give it to him. So I'm glad that Cusack didn't fight too hard.
No,
for
he could see that. He could see that for sure. Saya Whitlock and all these other these guys. Yeah, it was. We just called up actors we liked, and said, do you want to come to London for a couple of days? Please, it's going to be fun. Some nice dinners and the cool, be in a cool movie. But yeah, I mean, obviously we had a casting director that came up with, good ideas for this. But, with Isaiah, it's really important when you have those small parts inside a delicate story, you need somebody who can really pull it off, and not like an advanced extra who comes up and winging it. You need a proper actor to make it work, and that's always important.
And that's one of my favorite moments when he comes up to help fix the air conditioning. Just the non-bullshit of it, it grounds the movie in a weird way, because it's like, you have that coupled with the fact that you've seen Enslin go to these places, and all they want to do, all the people, like, they want to sell the B&B owners, they want to sell the horror thing and their attic room, and there's ghosts in there, and drive that. And then you meet Olin, the manager of the Dolphin, and he's doing everything he can to keep him out of the room and to downplay the horrors of it, and like, no, I don't want this. I don't want the publicity, whatever, which is kind of how it'd be if 1408 as a room existed in real life. One, it'd probably be boarded up and people would have, whatever this whole, the owners don't want it closed, stuff that you kind of have to throw in there. That wouldn't be reality. But the reality, of the manager going, please, whatever you want to do, you can have access to whatever, just don't be there. Or, the guy that's coming up to fix the AC that knows about the room that works there and goes, just, I ain't coming in there, but you can pop this off and do it yourself. I don't know, just little things like that ground it in a way that, like, kind of lets the supernatural psychological horror stuff that comes a little bit later work more, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. It's a contrast. But I also, when we started out our discussion here today, I said about 1408, you can definitely see it in two different ways. You can see it as a man in a hotel room from hell, or you can see it as a man that's losing his mind in a very sort of normal, boring hotel room. And that scene with Isaiah is sort of, it have both both sides, and I like that. I like that aspect of it. A funny anecdote is also that, I mean, Olin is written as a Olin is written in the script as a sort of quite rounded white guy, balding white guy. And when we were trying to figure out who's going to play him, I know Bob Weinstein called me one day and said, Quentin Tarantino read the script and he really liked it, but he felt like wouldn't it be cool if Sam Jackson played Olin? And I was like, well, if Quentin says that, that's a really good idea. And so that's how Sam Jackson ended up in the film. We were shooting one night in New York. We were shooting in England, in the UK, in London. We were shooting a couple of days in Los Angeles for Enslin's, home base and a couple of scenes there. And then
the surfing and whatnot.
He's surfing at Manhattan Beach and the post office exterior and a couple of other things. And then we were one night in New York to shoot outside this hotel, the exterior of the hotel. Everything else, the interior of the hotel, everything else is in London. But so the hotel was really welcoming, and they really they made a green room in their room 1408 in the hotel, which was fun. They had a room 1408, so we met this guy who was in charge of all of this. The hotel manager came up to us, and we were looking at him, and he had this little name thing on him, and can you guess what it said?
Was it Olin?
It was Olin. I'm not kidding.
Get the fuck
you.
Out of here.
And yes, get the fuck out of here. That's what we said also. And he said, I say, are you kidding us? Is that your name? And he was like, yeah, that's I'm Olin. And so we were there with Olin in room 1408 in New York. And it was the most bizarre thing ever. And, I have so many friends and read about people who never sort of, when they check into a hotel, they got room 1408, they kindly ask to change room. It happens all the time. So that was very strange.
Yeah. Well, with that happening, I regret to inform you, as soon as we're done with this interview, the walls are going to come down and you're still making this movie. That's how it's going to be. You thought you lived the last, almost 20 years of your life? Nah, you're still making that movie. That's crazy. I mean, I'm more on the skeptic side of things. I'm not super a big believer in the afterlife. I'm not a religious man. You know, I kind of feel like what happens after we die is the same thing that happens before we're born. You know, that makes sense to me, but you know, I don't know. There's a little coincidence happening there. You're making your movie and I don't know. That seems a lot of coincidence, you know, to not be something that you could easily read in some scary shit.
Stephen King told me this story when we talked before shooting 1408. I asked him about The Shining and so on, and he told this anecdote when in the middle of the night Stephen King was sleeping, and then the phone rang, and he picked it up, and a voice said, hi, this is hi, Stephen, are you awake? Yeah, this is Stanley. I'm in London. I was shooting here, The Shining, and I just need to ask you something. Very, very. Do you have a minute? I say, yeah, okay. What? Does God exist? And Stephen said, something like, well, that's a very big question, Stanley. It's it depends on who you are, where you come from, how you see things, and so on and so on, and a very individual situation. And then and Stanley Kubrick said, okay, great, yeah, thank you, Stephen, and they put down the phone, and then that was that. But I always wanted to make a short movie about that telephone conversation, Stanley Kubrick calling up Stephen King asking if God exists. I think that's great.
That's how much interaction did you have with King? Because I know from personal experience that he was rooting for the movie. Because I've interviewed him a couple of times over the years. The very first time was in 2007. And I interviewed him for this website I was writing for called Ain't It Cool News. And he legit, the very first thing we sat down, and I'm like a big Stephen King nerd. So I'm like, just, outside my body thing. And he's like, I know your site. He's like, I just read a test screening review from 1408 and they say it's going to be pretty good. And I'm like, I remember that review, coming in. And it's like, yep, I think it is going to be good. And he does this fist pump in the air going, yay, we got a good one or whatever. So I know he was at least pulling for you guys.
No, he still is. I read an article the other day that I'm sort of pinned myself on IMDb, so I get the articles in when films that I made and so on. Mm-hmm. And there was an article just recently when he still sort of seemed pissed off that Cusack wasn't more recognized for the performance of 1408, and right. He should have been nominated for something and blah, blah, blah. So he's still. Definitely rooting for the film. I didn't, I talked to him, and before the film, we started shooting him, I read the script. He was very, extremely, I mean, you talked to him yourself. He was very pleasantly low-key and very respectful, and, this is your film, and, you read the script, and just good luck, go and get it. And I made a film, we cut it, we put it together and all of that, and then we shipped it out to Maine, to his hometown there, and they put it up in the in the local cinema. I wasn't there, and he came with a couple of friends or whatever and saw the film and let us know afterwards that, you know, he was very, very pleased with the film. I was very happy with the film, as he had said in many occasions afterwards. So obviously there was a big stone from my weight from my shoulder, because I had so much respect for him. I made films made from books before, quite a few, and it's always, that's the first audience you're worried about. That's the writer of the source material. Right. But in this case, it was it worked out really well.
No, that's awesome. We've mentioned Stanley Kubrick a couple of times in this chat. So when you're making something like 1408, you know, you're sitting there, you have your cast, you're about to, you know, you're planning your shots, you're doing all this stuff. How conscious are you of the other giant Stephen King haunted hotel movie? Like, is this something that you had to consciously try to avoid making parallels to? Because I think that your movie has its own very unique identity and is able to work well because of that, because you're not like nodding to The Shining a lot, you know, minus an axe in the final scene, which, you know, that's the kind of shit is cool, you know, where it's not like you're linger on a photo of Nicholson in the July 4th ball or whatever in the hallway. You know what I mean? You're not doing anything like overt, you know, for a callback. Is that something you thought of, or you're just consciously trying?
No, it's nothing. I think that's things that guys like you think about and should think about, because that's your job. No, but you know what I mean. I think Stephen King experts, as yourself and other ones too, they you see these things and obviously, but I wasn't not thinking about avoiding anything. I was just trying to tell the story and shoot the film the best I can. Obviously, you know, like everybody else, I've seen The Shining many times, and Kubrick is, you know, maybe the most famous and greatest filmmaker of our time. So it's there, but nothing I worry about or was thinking about when we were trying to make our little film as good as possible. You don't have time to theorize like that. You know, your every day is full of stuff you need to deal with.
Well, that's a very healthy answer to that. So, in honor of my late great co-host Scott, he was obsessed with what he called the weird little hammer guy in this movie. Mm. What's up with the weird little hammer dude? Like, what? Like, I think we did a little digging when he found out that was somebody that Cusack maybe brought in, somebody he was training with or something.
Yeah, that's his sensei. Yeah. That's his sensei and his personal trainer and sort of a life coach. Great guy, very, very down to earth, very, very not crazy. we were all a bit crazy, you know. John and I and everybody was a bit crazy. He was not crazy. How it came about. So we did this scene. I was kind of nervous about this, I remember, because, you know, you're going to mirror himself, and how are we going to shoot that in a good way? I remember thinking about that quite a lot. But anyway, we said, we need this, we need somebody, you know, but it can't be too generic, or it can't be too, like, what does it look like? It's like, and then he was in the room, he's like, you know, what about him? And then he had his hair, but we just sort of messed up his hair. And he's very physical, obviously, because that's what he's doing. And he was like perfect. He was like a stuntman. And with this crazy grin, he became from this sort of very, very sort of together person, he became this crazy hammer man, as you say, and so that's the story about him, and he had a very short but memorable presence in that film.
So that was born fully out of wanting to add a little oomph to the moment where he's reflected, right, and he sees himself across the way.
I mean, there was in the script, there was actually written in the script that he gets attacked in some way or another, you know, behind, and that the first the mirror image get, you know, and then he realized that you know, is obviously needs to be the same with him. So that was in the script,
right.
But not much more of a description of this person, this attacker, and obviously we don't, you know, we just tried to. We're thinking about how we can make that a bit unique, and that's how we ended up with him, and
right.
he was quite unique looking.
Well, I only have a few more things that I want to grill you about here. One of them is the paintings, and because that's the stuff from the short story that always like really got me, was just how the paintings would, you know, slowly change or come to life at certain points. Which, you know, maybe is a little bit of Haunted Mansion, which I also love that there's a reference to Haunted Mansion at the beginning of the movie. Big Haunted Mansion Disney Parks nerd here. So, but, you know, maybe it's my love of that. But, like, when you're knowing that you have a ship painting and that painting of the family, you know, that is kind of innocuous, it's dark but innocuous, that then changes later. Like, you know, what was your process going through those things, and you know, having those set up in the rooms where they are? And
when I was little, I mean, when I was like I don't know, what, 10, maybe 10, 11 or something, I saw this short horror story on TV back in Sweden where I grew up. I think, I don't know if it was English or American, but either of this, it was a really creepy, it really carried it with me. It was about somebody living in an old mansion, and they had paintings there, and suddenly the painting started to change. So there was a graveyard, the painting of a graveyard that was outside the house, and suddenly you see how somebody, you know, the painting changed, and you see somebody like crawling out of that grave and start to walk. Yeah. Next day, the character started to walk towards the house, and at some point reality and collide with you know the abstract stuff that happens in the painting, and he could hear somebody walking around the house. That I thought that was really, really creepy. So when we came to the paint, in as you say, the paintings were in Stephen King's short story, but I remember thinking about those early childhood experiences of the changing painting. Mm. So they have a certain functioning here in the story, and they're quite well described in the short story, if I don't remember wrong, the way they are, the family there and the boat and all of that. And we even put the hammer guy is on the ship.
Yeah.
For instance, you know, and then obviously he freaks out and tries to destroy the painting, and then the whole place becomes an ocean, and he's on a sinking ship. So thematically, it hangs together in the sense that it's part of his of the breakdown of his sense
right.
of reality, you know.
And how it's a gradual thing, and that's where you're kind of conditioning the audience to get to a point where you don't realize, like, you're following along with Enslin as he's like talking into the recorder, and it's all sounding logical to you because you're seeing everything through his eyes.
Yeah,
you know. But then when you're getting bits and pieces of his nonsensical ramblings, you go, oh my god, so this is maybe what it's actually like to go crazy. You know, it all makes perfect sense when you're in the moment doing it and saying whatever you're saying.
Yeah,
and we all have a little bit of that, like, you know, it's like trying to explain a complex dream that you just had, and a dream that made complete sense, but then when you're trying to explain it to somebody the next morning, you realize it's like, yeah, I was walking on a sidewalk and my shoes were actually gloves, but I know it sounds weird, but it made total sense in the dream, you know. It was like that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
I love that feeling that you evoke in that movie. And some of that comes into play here with, you know, something, again, I think this is a kind of a make it or break it moment for the movie. And that is the fake out that kicks off the third act, where it's the was it all in his head sequence. I think, and we've discussed this on the show before when kind of talking about your movie. Matter of fact, the first person we talked about the movie with on the KingCast was Mike Flanagan. You know, who's a filmmaker. He did Gerald's Game and Dr. Sleep.
I know Mike Flanagan's work very well. What did he say about it?
Well, he loved it, and he also said that he thinks that he subconsciously ripped it off for his first movie, because his first movie, well, maybe not his first movie. I think he said he ripped it off for Oculus, which is the haunted mirror movie that he made, and he might have been saying more about ripping it off from King's story than your movie, but I wouldn't be surprised because I know he loves your movie. He matter of fact, I've been to his place, and he has the alarm clock from your movie. He has that prop sitting in a display. Really? In an honor.
Did he buy it? On eBay.
He must have. Yeah, he got on some prop collector thing.
Yeah.
But in talking about this, I think we both dove into how you execute that fake out. The reason why it works is because you spend so much time living in it. Right. It's not just he wakes up on the beach and, oh my God, it was all for real. And, or it was all in his mind. And then he goes into the post office. Like, he lives a little bit of a life.
Yeah.
Right. You get glimpses of his day to day, and to the point that when you reveal, like, no, he's actually still in the room, the audience has already like dropped their guard. Right. They've already waited for that. Like, the audience knows horror movies and they know it's like, it's not going to be that easy. But the more time you spend outside the room and in his life, you go, the more it goes, oh, well, maybe that was it. And then you go, ha, fuck you, got you. Was that kind of your plan? And maybe I just, instead of me talking about this, maybe you should talk about it. Maybe I'm talking.
I enjoy hearing you talk about my movie.
Okay,
it's really interesting sometimes because it's things that it's great to hear somebody who really knows the movie, somebody's perspective. Mm. So thank you for that. But I think what I really wanted to do was to piss the audience off in a good way for a while because, they wake up and he was like, oh no, it was all in his mind.
It's all a dream. It's definitely not a dream.
And now, what's happening now? Oh no, we're back in reality. Okay, he's gonna, he meets his wife and ex-wife, and they at the restaurant, and there is some sort of, he thinks he sees somebody, one of the spooky ladies that in the hotel mm-hmm. room, but it's just the waitress, and there is some signs that, but it's in his head. So he had his dreams. And then I really wanted to create a situation where we at least expect it when it goes to the post office we've been to earlier in the film. And mm-hmm. I love this idea, but I think that's a moment that really works for me, personally, when they beat up this post office. It's a guy from the hotel. Is there, one of the clerks from the hotel, and the assistant hotel manager from the Dolphin Hotel is in the post office. Maybe not everybody recognized them, but it's the same guys that we have seen in the film in different other scenes, And so wanted to sort of, make the audience wonder what is this going to go. I mean, what's happening now in reality? Right. What's going to, and then suddenly we have this moment. So that was the plan. That was my thinking when we tried to lay this puzzle.
Right. Well, I think it works, and it also sets up the kind of final emotional gut punch, because another one of my favorite parts, and maybe this is this is kind of what jumped into my mind when you were talking about King saying Cusack should have been nominated or his work should have been noticed here. The reaction he has when he's revisited by his daughter, his dead daughter, and then watching her die again in his arms.
Yeah.
And then just that he has the greatest, and I'm sorry for laughing at it because it's a deeply emotional, like, fucked up scene. But when he jerks and the ashes version of her shatters in his arms, just the like complete look of shock and blank and what the fuck is going on his face is the thing that I keep going back to when I think about the movie. Like, just that it this is a guy that it couldn't be broken by a lot, but this is, might be what does it.
Look, your point of something here that I think is really important in the film also, and that's all that's a dark humor in the film, because this is not a fun moment in any stretch. But John, also in other scenes, a lot of other scenes, when he's alone in the room and the mini bar and all in a mini bar and all of that. And also, he have the toothpick in his mouth when he when he in the post office, and when he all this drama when he goes into back into the room, he's just standing there all confused. The room is a fucking mess, and he still have this toothpick in his mouth, and he just, and he takes it out and he flips it away, and you know, little things like that just bring some sort of absurdity into it. And when he climbs up in the vent and you know, he's chased by this crazy corpse and he falls down into the room and he says, oh, good to be back, and you know, things that worked really well with the audience, when I things that that audience picked up from, and I saw it in big audience screenings the first time, they're really laughing, the good laugh in those scenes. So and I you know, I think what works so well with him is the things that you talk about and point out with the girl. It's a very strong moment, and I think John's performing there is pretty great, you know. And it's not easy, you know, those kinds of things to balance it. But he makes it very heartbreaking, and you know, you're there in this sort of environment, and this spook girl is coming, and you got to play against all this. You know, like this old bones and ash and stuff like that. But he really delivered that. I totally agree with you on that.
It's the point in the movie where it's like Olin's words come around. It's an evil fucking room. It's not evil because it's trying to scare you or whatever. Look at what emotional manipulation it's doing here. You know, this is the room at its most evil to force a parent to relive their child dying again.
I think the room 48 is a very individual journey. If you walk into the room, you will have a completely different journey in that room. And if I walked into it, or one of our friends walked into it, they would all have a very, very different journey, because the room cares about who you are. The room feeds of you and your memories and your experiences. That's what the room will find and come and haunt you with.
Well, I love the movie. We're reaching the end of our time here. I don't know if we have time to grapple with this, but I should bring it up. There's like 47 different endings to this movie. Can you tell me a little bit about?
It's not 40. Yeah, we have time to go through the ending.
I would love to know your preferred ending, and just kind of. I know that, you know, the legend around is that there was a test screening. You know, the ending was changed as a result of test screenings and stuff. But I'd love to hear your.
We can debunk that. We can debunk that. We shot the film with the ending that ended up being the theatrical ending. And while we were doing in post, we were doing some additional photography. And then I remember talking to Bob Weinstein at the time, and we said, you know, maybe we should. You know, just for fun, or you know, we could experiment to do an alternative ending and see how that there was some. I don't know all the details now, but it was not that it not tested well the ending. It had nothing to do with that. But let's try an ending. So we shot the ending when Sam Jackson comes to the funeral and he has the stuff, and he suddenly sees Enslin in the rearview mirror, and there's this great jump scare. I think that we were after something, you know, a little bit more scary in the end. And then we end up in New York and we see Enslin, you know, the deceased Enslin as another ghost in the room. And he hears his daughter's voice and he walks up. It's kind of neat. And, you know, we had a really good jump scare. We tested it. The audience were like jumping out of the seats when Enslin sits in the back seat and all of that. But we came to the conclusion, and the audience helped us to come to the conclusion that the emotional ending was more rewarding, and that's what they wanted, and that's what I wanted too in the end. And we all felt that ending when he sits with a tape recorder and hears daughter's voice, and she hears it too, was stronger and much more emotional. The other one was worked, and it was kind of, you know, it had a couple of good moments, but this was more right for the film, so that's where we ended. So we chose to keep the original ending, and then when they made the DVD, one of the DVDs, and they called it director's cut, and they put in that ending and some deleted scenes and stuff. So that's how it ended up there. So it was not a big, it was not like you know, it was not a big conflict or the audience hated this or that. It was just, you know, it was a matter of what way to go and how to balance it up. But I think we came to the right decision when it came to the theatrical version of the film.
Yeah, I agree. I think the theatrical ending is definitely my favorite, but yeah. I can see the appeal of like, oh no, it'd be really fun to have a nice jump at the end. Mm. You know, I think everybody, especially when they're making genre, they are, you know, love to kind of send the audience out yeah. buzzing in that way. I can totally see the appeal for that. But it's good to hear that, you know, that it was more like, hey, let's, you know, we have it, but let's try it. This could be a different flavor. This could be a fun different yeah. flavor versus, you know, because I know, especially that era with the Weinsteins and Dimension and all yeah. that stuff, they were yeah. pretty notorious for going, okay, no, we're going to take this away and let you do, you know, and not let you have the ending you want.
Yeah,
so.
No, it was never a case of that. I think they always had ideas, and Bob, you know, Bob had ideas about this and that. But, you know, eventually yeah. I understood that, you know, we had test screen. He understood that this sort of my version of the film really worked well, and he wasn't going to meddle with it. I think also right. it came from Brian, you know, one of the greatest jump scares I experienced mm-hmm. in the cinema together with an audience is the last moment of Carrie, Brian De Palma's Carrie, when yeah. Sissy Spacek's hand comes up and grabs her there from the ashes of the house, if you remember that.
I do, yeah.
Moment. Of course you do. But I remember seeing that, you know, seeing that.
I'd be in trouble if I didn't.
No, exactly. No, but the film came out and I was, again, I was a teenager, but I saw it in Sweden. But when that happened, when the hand came out, the audience flipped out. And I never sort of, I don't know if I ever felt a collective jump scare work so well as that did, that moment did, and I think we were trying to go out with a bang more with that right. alternative ending. So I think that's where it came from. But the ending we ended up with is more true to the film, I think.
Yeah. No. I mean, it really is about a guy that's desperately hunting for proof of the afterlife, because if there's proof of the afterlife, then his daughter's out there somewhere still existing. Right. And so when you're, you know, thematically, when you're ending with him having gone through all this and you don't know what's in his head, what isn't. And the fact that not only he hears her voice on the tape, but the, you know, estranged wife does too.
Yeah. Yeah.
He finds what he's been looking for, what he opens the movie searching for.
Yeah.
You know, he's not looking for ghosts. He's just looking for proof that his daughter isn't just memories at this point, right? So,
Or is it proof that he's still in the room?
Or is it proof that he's still in the room, which could very well be too. That's the dark read, my friend. That's the one that I'd like to
think about that for a moment. Think about that for a moment.
Well, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for chatting with me, Mikhail. Do you want to give a final pitch and a reminder of people where they can see Slingshot?
Slingshot, my latest film, a distant cousin to 1408, in a way, opens next Friday in the United States, the 30th of August, in a cinema near you. It's a ride. Several great actors, Casey Affleck, Lawrence Fishburne, Tomo Capone from The Boys, Emily Beecham, takes you on a great ride, and a lot of twists and turns, a psychological drama, thriller. I really, really hope you enjoy it. Tell all your friends about it.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for stopping by and chatting up your new movie and reminiscing a little bit about 1408. I wish Scott could have been here for it because he loved the movie, but I am super psyched that you got to come on the show, man.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun revisit 1408 again.
Many thanks to Mikhail Hafstrom. That dude was such a pleasure to talk to, and I'm so happy to have gotten a little into the weeds on the making of one of the better Stephen King adaptations, and one that still to this day doesn't really get its due. I don't get it, but you know, when you talk to people who've seen 1408, they know it's good shit, and I'm really happy that Mikhail stopped by. As mentioned before, his new film Slingshot is out this Friday. Thank the man for coming on the show and bullshitting a little bit about Stephen King with me by checking out his new flick. Next week, I have another director on the hook. If everything stays on schedule, you'll be hearing me chat with J.T. Molnar. That's the writer-director of the currently out Strange Darling and the guy who also happened to pen the currently shooting The Long Walk. Interesting, interesting. Yeah, I'm going to have lots of questions for this dude. He's a big King nerd, and the title he's bringing to the table, well, it's a KingCast favorite, so I think y'all will be excited about it. Revival will be up for discussion next week with Mr. J.T. Molnar. It's going to be a wild one, especially considering the fact that the guest co-host seat is being filled by our friend Winter Mitchell. So that's going to be a bonkers discussion, I think. It's going to be a lot of fun. Tune in next Wednesday for that one. And this Friday on the Patreon, I'll be checking in with Mr. Vincenzo Natali. He's the director of Cube, Splice, and The Tall Grass, etc. He's been on the show a few times. He's coming back for this bonus episode where we can discuss Stephen King's multiple collaborations with the legendary late great artist Bernie Wrightson. So that means we'll be talking about the artwork in The Stand, Dark Tower, and of course, Cycle of the Werewolf. I'm always happy to chat Stephen King with Vincenzo. This is going to be another banger bonus episode on the Patreon. And make sure to sign up to get access to that one, as well as over 4 years of bonus episodes that exist only at the Patreon. So go to patreon.com/thekingcast. Sign up, throw us a few bucks. It'll be well worth your while. You've got so much stuff over there. Commentaries, interviews, deep dives, the entirety of Shelbyville, our RPG show. It all exists over on the Patreon, and the community over there fucking rules. Go join it. So one other plug I want to do before I sign off, go check out The Spiel. That's our other show currently running through the episode Scott and I had banked on that. If you like the KingCast, you'll like The Spiel. It's essentially the exact same format because we're very original over here. But instead of talking about Stephen King stuff, we're talking about Steven Spielberg stuff. So lots of great guests over there. We have a lot of KingCast favorites. We have a lot of newbies. And so the latest episode that's out as I'm releasing this is DC Pearson Talking Transformers, produced by Steven Spielberg. So we got that. We got Dee Wallace talking about E.T. We got Haley Joel Osment talking about AI. We got Brian Michael Bendis fawning over 1941. A lot of great stuff over there. So check out The Spiel wherever you get your podcasts. All right. So that should be it in terms of plugs. See y'all next week for J.T. Molnar and Winter Mitchell talking about Revival. And this Friday, the Bernie Wrightson discussion over at the Patreon. So I think that's about it. Adios, folks. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abhi Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director. And editing is done by yours truly.